You're with Mike Ryan on today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Can you believe it's a Monday already? My weekend was not long enough. Not that I'm complaining at all. Had a lovely day yesterday. Had three potato cakes, there you are, at lunchtime, or potato scallops, they call them in Queensland, down by the beach. Gentle sea hurricane, but it was a very nice day. Then went to look at a few different places around the Gold Coast, and we all should do that maybe in our own backyard, is what I'm trying to say, because our backyard is, I never knew some of these places existed. And all in all, a very good day, and then went home and a couple of glasses of Pinot from Tasmania, and the world was looking much brighter, which I don't know if Australia is at the moment. Now, Peter Dutton, the former Defence Minister, has become the leader of the Liberal Party, with former Environment Minister Susan Ley as his deputy. I can understand Peter Dutton, but Susan Ley, give me a break. I mean, more on her as we go into the weeks and months, but Susan Ley, her as deputy leader, really says why the LNP failed miserably. Speaking for the first time after being elected unopposed by the party, Peter Dutton went straight to the offensive, saying Labor would be tough for the Australian people and claimed they weren't ready to govern. Well, the Australian people thought the opposite. They thought that the LNP were not good enough to govern. Dutton says by the time of the next election in 2025, we will have presented a plan to the Australian people, which will clean up Labor's inevitable mess and lay out our own vision. At the moment, Labor's got to fix up the LNP's mess. So maybe I think Peter Dutton should practice what my dad used to tell me before he gave me a foot up the backside, a still tongue in a wise head. Now, to make things worse, we have Susan Ley as the deputy leader of the LNP, and David Littleproud has been elected the leader of the Nationals and defeating former deputy PM Barnaby Joyce, who was soiled, I think, too many times. He was damaged goods, as somebody once said. But David Littleproud, give me a break. Now, this is David Littleproud, by the way, tearing up at his first press conference as the new leader of the, what do you call them, the Nationals or the Inconsequentials. I mean, the guy I thought would have done much better is Matt Canavan, but this is David Littleproud.
40 years ago, I joined the National Party as a six-year-old boy handing out for my father at the Chinchilla Courthouse as he tried to become the member for Condamine. I am all that is the National Party. I believe passionately in the National Party because we are all there is about regional and rural Australia. We are the conscience of rural and regional Australia right here in this Parliament. The National Party today starts its journey towards 2025 with a vibrant team ready to articulate the policies that are important to regional rural Australia, but also to draw on the experience of two former Deputy Prime Ministers, in Barnaby Joyce and Michael McCormack, to build that bridge of unity and purpose.
And Senator Perrin Davey from New South Wales will be the Deputy Leader for the Nationals, but I really thought Matt Canavan should have been there right up front. I mean, the guy is handles the media well, handles the public well, enunciates very, very well. Anyway, I suppose that's called progress, and we can't have that with the Conservatives. And bad word, by the way, Conservatives, because they are Labor-lite, much to their horror. They are a very light form of Albanese. Now, sugar prices are expected to also soar due to the export restrictions imposed by a number of key producing nations seeking to tame rising domestic food prices. The impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, which seriously undermined global supply chains, has been dramatically aggravated by the crisis in Ukraine and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Russia. The conflict between the two major grain exporters has disrupted global supplies. And I would imagine There's people out there saying, sugar, who cares? Well, used in a lot of products, by the way, used in many, many products. I think also in alcohol it's used. And one who enjoys the odd drop or two, or maybe three too many, would be quite dismayed if that really hurt our alcoholic supply. I mean, the supply chain of a good whiskey or a bad whiskey is just too scary to contemplate.
Gaining perspectives.
It's well-balanced conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Many governments, in concert with mainstream media and big tech, are involved in blatant censorship and promotion of propaganda. This could not be denied after experiencing the last 2 years of COVID madness. These developments have been disastrous, further eroding trust in government, its institutions, and of course, the lame media or the legacy media. There are serious headwinds about to hit the global economy, but we saw last week corporate leaders and mainstream media living it up in Davos. Woohoo! Just talking about the need to recalibrate free speech and data protection, coming a measurement of consumers' carbon footprint, and therefore more surveillance, more pandemics, and or a pandemic treaty to usurp sovereign and inalienable human rights. It really is a nightmare. Gregory Copley, AM, an Australian citizen who's had a career of more than a half century in service to governments and societies around the world in the fields of intelligence, strategic philosophy, and industry. Gregory is the president of the International Strategic Studies Association, as well as founder and editor-in-chief of Defence and Foreign Affairs Group of Publications. He's also the director of intelligence at the Global Information System, GIS, an online encrypted access global intelligence service which monitors 290 countries and territories and provides current strategic intelligence solely to governments around the world. First of all, Greg, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Mike.
What's your thoughts on the growing control of Western governments and how they want to seek this control over their populations?
What we are clearly evidencing is around the world in what we used to think of as democratic societies is this growing tendency towards authoritarianism. Mind you, I'm not sure how much I should say about that, Mike, because to quote your father, a silent tongue in a wise head means that I should probably shut up now. But
don't do that. My grandmother always said, enunciate, so go for it.
Perfect. I like your grandmother better.
Much better looking.
Well, yes. This growing authoritarianism is one of the reversals we always see to democracy and freedoms every time there's a crisis. Because it's pretty much a rule that authoritarian societies can react more quickly to crises and threats and opportunities. And therefore, when we have a major war, we see that democracy is suspended while governments go into an authoritarian mode and deal with the problem. And then hopefully, after victory is achieved, they hand our democracy back to us, except that we see in World War I, World War II, particularly major global crises, governments took the authority from the people and didn't give it all back to the public. So our freedoms were eroded. And the more you erode freedom, the more you erode democracy. Let's face it, democracy is meaningless without freedom. So if you're going to have one or the other, go for the freedom. But when governments keep imposing rules in exchange for granting benefits and entitlements, we see that we get a less entrepreneurial society, a society which is less capable of fluid maneuver and innovation. So we see that societies which are more free and less regulated tend to be better at coming up with new ways of improving the economy. So all of these erosions of our freedoms, which occurred during the COVID lockdowns in the North America and the United and United Kingdom and Australia and New Zealand, resulted in a dramatic curtailment of our economic capabilities, not necessarily evident in the immediate sense, because with the printing of money, everyone was being placated. The reality is, though, that we wasted a couple of years when we should have been retooling our societies to meet what is emerging as a totally new world. We've been on the brink of a change of eras, if you like, for the last couple of decades, and we're now well into that change of the global strategic architecture. And we've just wasted a couple of years moving from that old economy and that old technology to the new technologies. And we've been sitting back fat, dumb and happy saying, well, our governments protected us. They printed a lot of money, which meant that we didn't have to work too hard or worry too much. But as I said in a book called Uncivilization, Urban Geopolitics in a Time of Chaos in 2012, I said, the majority of people prefer the certainty of oppression to the uncertainty of freedom. And unfortunately, what the rise of authoritarianism in Australia demonstrated, particularly in Queensland, Victoria, and Western Australia, was that an enormous, an overwhelming majority of the population, maybe 80% of the population, preferred not to make decisions, preferred to kowtow to arbitrary decisions by government, rather than to take responsibility for their own security and prosperity and future.
That would explain, though, why. I mean, it's. I mean, we just had the federal election, and everybody knows that Labor is very, very, very. They're a lot tougher. They're meaner. They love this authority, this control. And you just look at Victoria, as you mentioned, Victoria, Queensland, WA, and even now with South Australia, with their all their new rules being bought in that. That promise incarceration and huge monetary fines if you don't do what you're told. But what you see though is that people voting for the more heavy-handed side of politics. And you look at Victoria, Dan Andrews. I mean, that guy is we all thought was disliked immensely. The word is he's just going to romp it in, and the Victorians think he did a great job. Look at Palaszczuk in Queensland. I mean, the same thing. You know, last seen stomping the coronavirus behind trees, but you know they believe that she saved their lives. And look at WA. Look at McGowan. The guy there was absolutely cruel to the population of WA, and they're all. Singing high from the tree. Is that the reason why that we feel safer then because of the authoritative figure and the control, and that we know that we go from A to B, B to C, C to D, and so on?
Well, historically, human beings are afraid of the unknown and of darkness more than of anything else in the world. Fear of the unknown drives us to seek certainty and seek comfort. None of this is surprising. And this is why Nikita Khrushchev, when he made a great speech to a momentous speech to the United Nations, said that when the time comes to hang the West, it will be the West who bids to supply the rope. And this is much of our mentality. We vote for our own demise in many respects. And this has been true of democracy for thousands of years. We tend to think that democracy is a modern invention of the enlightened mind of the educated urban populace who can now take their future in their own hands and consistently improve our lot through the years. That growth is linear, that the improvement of knowledge and welfare and wisdom is linear. But what Plato said, of course, was that because of the way democracies emerge is that they become ochlocracies, mob rule. And this is because when people are allowed to vote for their own benefits, they will do so with absolute disregard, even for the welfare of their children and their grandchildren. And that's where we are today. And once you get a society which has consistently voted for entitlements and benefits and rights, as though there is such a thing in the world as rights, when in fact we don't have rights. We only get what we can defend. But when we get these rights given to us by governments ostensibly, we can't, there's no mechanism for taking back those rights when they're no longer affordable. When GM, General Motors in the United States, was going broke, it was because they had made unrestricted promises of entitlements to workers and retired workers into the indefinite future, when they had no such guarantees of unrestricted growth, if you like, of income from the marketplace. So when the marketplace turned against General Motors, or General Motors was not able to grow the market sufficiently, inevitably they couldn't, they ended up in a position where they couldn't pay the pensions. So that was the collapse of General Motors, which caused its nationalization and reprivatization under the Obama administration. Mm. But you can't have a system which will survive indefinitely if it is not in control of consistently raising the economy to the level where it can afford these entitlements. Mm. And we're in that position right now. And we're in that position because democracy and growth, like all things which are in human societies, they have lifespans. We saw, for example, the growth of the global marketplace from the end of World War II until now, or till early in this century. We had a period where returning servicemen married, urbanized, had children. We saw the fruits of the medical advances during World War II, creating more live births per thousand. We saw the lifespan of people extended and so on. So you had a global population which expanded from 2.5 billion in 1950 to about 7.8 billion today. And at the same time, a growing standard of wealth for most of the world's population, rising all literally in everywhere around the world in different proportions, and rising caloric intake and the like. And so you had this incredible situation of a perpetually rising marketplace. So all you had to do more or less was go into business and you were guaranteed that there was going to be a market out there. But the problem was that the baby boom generation didn't replace itself. So as a result, the baby boom generation is now dying off around the world, including places like China. And starting now, but within 10 years, we're going to see the global population decline massively, except in India and Africa, where the process has been delayed by about 10 to 15 years. And we'll start to see that process occur in India and Africa in about 10 to 15 years. So now we're in a situation where we're facing a long period of constantly declining population, therefore constantly declining marketplace size. And we haven't got economic policies and strategies which are geared to declining market size. We're seeing the situation where urbanization has peaked globally, and in Australia it's in the 80, high 80s, early low 90% of the population urbanized. In the United States, in the 80%. China went from 5% urbanization in, say, 1911 when the revolution occurred to 65% today. And what's happening is that we saw this great increase in urbanization, which basically meant an increase in wealth, but it also denuded the countryside. It changed the nature of thinking in populations. Urban thinking is very different from rural and regional thinking, for example. So we're now in this situation where everything is about to fall off a cliff and we're not ready for it. But we still go on insisting that we have our entitlements, and Labour governments here and Democratic governments in the United States come into office thinking that they can get elected by promising that they're going to give more stuff to more people. And as Maggie Thatcher said, well, pretty soon governments run out of other people's money to give away. So we're getting to that situation, and we're getting to the stage where the great urban centers are becoming less appealing and less livable. So people are already, and because of COVID in part, starting to leave the cities. And when you get a decline in the population of cities, you get a decline in the value of properties in cities. And when you think that our whole economic model today is based on leveraging assets so that you can invest in lifestyle or in research and development or acquisitions, that's going to go away, because if the value of property goes down, and it is going down in a number of areas, and it will increasingly be the case, then the ability to leverage those assets to invest in properties or invest in R&D and the like, that's going to go away. So we're going to start to see a spiraling impact of declining wealth, which we will have to deal with. And we can deal with it. We can still ensure the prosperity of the individual and communities if we look at creative economic models and don't just look at saying, well, we've made the society is so wealthy, we can afford to give ourselves whatever we want.
Do you think the I look at censorship, either from the legacy media or government encourage censorship through social media interference and stuff, and the message that is getting out isn't the reality of the whole scenario, is it? And no. This in itself, if you're not given the right data, you're going to come up with the the wrong answer at the end of the day. Do you think it's compounded by a variety of interests that are intertwined, like this spaghetti, the bowl of spaghetti on steroids? That's all, as you mentioned before, it's all, you know, what can it do for us? What can we get it, you know, get out of it? Instead of saying, this is the answer, this is the solution to make this a better outcome. And so we're getting all, you know, the public isn't getting the right information, you know, debatable whether they want to know that, because they may be, as you said, they may feel comfortable with the oppression. But the information that's getting out is wrong. It's the censorship is truly distorting the facts. And until we get those facts that the, you know, not people like us who are on one side, it's the fence sitters and the ones that are thinking about sitting on the fence, we need to be able to convince them the severity of the situation. So how important or how serious is this censorship in stifling our move forward?
Well, most people don't want to get involved in things. They just want to be left alone. They don't have a knowledge or a desire to get involved in telling other people what to do, but they're afraid of going against the popular will as it seems to be expressed by, if you like, a politically correct society. And the reality is that because of the way societies frame themselves, the great concern is not Orwell's 1984 with the censorship by the state, although that is, of course, a great concern, but the real concern is self-censorship. And self-censorship comes from people's desire to fit in, not rock the boat, not be attacked by their neighbors, not to be cancelled in the modern parlance. And so they conform. And as a result, if you conform, you don't ask questions when you conform. So we move from a knowledge-based society to a belief-based society. When societies feel secure, that's when they debate and that's when they learn through inquiry and the like. But when there's a threat, the whole pattern moves to one of political correctness. And it's basically the same as with fashion. You know, you show that you're on the right side of the fashion debate, or you're in with the in crowd if you dress in a certain fashion. So you need to do that if you want to be on the inside. And it goes all the way up the scale to what we see now is virtue signaling, having tangible physical indicators that you are really a nice person and that you support saving the planet and whatever. But you don't have to think about it. You've just got to virtue signal. And then you get into transpires then is reward signaling, because if you show that you're on the inside and you are rewarded, you are invited to the right parties, you are not frowned upon, you're not spat on and the like, you go through that. And of course, there are other elements to this, including, punishment signaling. If you show that you are going to go against the crowd, you will be punished one way or another. And these modern attempts at cancel culture and the like are ways in which people lash out to to protect themselves. Political correctness and fashion are actually normal societal responses to threat. You show you're on the inside and you've got your crowd, you know who you can trust, you know who your friends are, and you know who the enemy is. So this becomes a totally self-censoring situation. And of course, it's been accelerated in the age of modern social media. I'm just doing a new book called The Collapse of Wisdom. And we look at how crowds move and how they have moved historically. And we're seeing, firstly, that modern levels of ignorance are about the same as the levels of ignorance of hunter-gatherer civilizations. So the modern urban dweller really is about as ignorant of the world as the hunter-gatherer going out trying to kill a mammoth. But it's so we're, if you like, trading on ignorance, not on knowledge, and at this stage. And there are two great books on that, which I recommend to you. One is called Crowds and Power, by Elias Canetti, who was a Bulgarian who got the Nobel Prize, the real Nobel Prize, the Nobel Prize for Literature, not the Nobel Peace Prize, which is a joke, but he got the Nobel Prize for Literature for this book. And it talks about how crowds and societies work, how people make decisions and how they survive within environments. And that followed another book called The Crowd by Gustave Le Bon in about 1890. And Le Bon's book was greatly studied by the Soviets and by the Communist Party of China to learn how they could induce crowd behaviors and create mass psychoses and the like, as of the type we just saw with the COVID fear pandemic. In fact, my most recent book is called The New Total War of the 21st Century and the Trigger of the Fear Pandemic, because when that came out in 2020, I was saying that this is not actually a medical pandemic in classical terms. This is something which has generated mass fear and therefore mass conformity. This is why people have, if you like, welcomed this oppression which has been imposed by their governments.
Look, we'll go to a commercial break, come back. I want to talk about your new book. My guest is Greg Copley. This is TNT Radio.
Dolores Cahill on TNT Radio.
They're engineering these cycles, right? If they know they want to have a cycle by changing the value of the loan-to-asset ratio, or that if the banks and the regulators work together and they know a cycle is coming, they can profit by it and also use the downturn in the cycle to claim the assets that they didn't actually own initially.
Exactly right, Dolores. What if you, as Kevin said, if you study history, what they do is they inflate assets and then they strip them from the people that they allegedly lend money to. When you understand how the money system really works, there are no loans as such, not in the way that they portray them to be. So what they do is they inflate, it's boom and bust. There should be no, there's no reason for boom and bust economies. It's created deliberately so that people can have their assets inflated and then taken from them. And then you rebuild, assets get inflated and they take them. The whole model is based on asset stripping. That's banking.
Weekends with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
St. Joseph's Indian School is much more than a school for Native American children.
It's like a family. Classes are fun here. I am learning about my culture.
Since 1927, St. Joseph's Indian School has provided children the education, health care, and support they need to succeed. To help give our kids brighter futures, learn more at stjo.org today.
Mask mandates don't work.
No.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Let's do it.
Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Another saying, Greg, my dad used to say, there's no rest for the wicked. Always bringing my dad into this, but no rest for the wicked. And you've authored or co-authored 36 books on strategic philosophy, history, geopolitics, energy, aviation, national planning, and poetry of all things. Tell us about the new book, The New Total War of the 21st Century and the Trigger of the Fear Pandemic.
Thanks, Mike. Well, I started to see how the model of total war had evolved throughout society. And it's always been there with us since very, very primitive times when you did everything to destroy your adversary. You used all of your resources against all of your adversary's resources. And gradually, as we, quote, civilized, we tried to regulate how wars were fought. They tended to go into a situation where the only people who could afford to go to war were kings and the like, and nobles. So you limited it because of that. But then we started to see that warfare became an all of society event. Napoleon really popularized, if you like, the concept of total war in the 18th and 19th centuries. But he didn't have to explain it. And it wasn't until about 1918 that Erich Ludendorff, the German general, said that we were in a state of total war in late World War I, where societies mobilized all their assets to fight the total state of another. He didn't really understand what he was talking about, because it was going to become even more pervasive than that. And my old partner, Stefan Personi, wrote a book in 1938 called Tomorrow's War, in which he outlined how much more warfare was about to get into the lives of every single individual. And he outlined how that would work out with what he saw coming up, which was World War II. Mm. And had Hitler read that, I think he would have made a number of different decisions and wouldn't have exposed himself to the ultimate defeat, which Germany had. But then we went into the Cold War, which was only called the Cold War because there was a great fear of peer-to-peer military conflict between the West, led by the United States, essentially, and the Soviet Union, leading the Warsaw Treaty states, and to a degree, the People's Republic of China. And the Cold War was one in which you did not risk going into military conflict for fear of escalation to nuclear levels in a total war scenario where it would be counter-city nuclear warfare, wiping out large elements of the human population. So the Cold War was seen as a war without conflict. But as Ronald Reagan said to Personi and me before he became president, he said, well, I know it's a Cold War, but shouldn't we win it? Which was a novel concept. And the Cold Warriors didn't understand or even like that concept, because they felt comfortable with the process of warfare and confrontation. But the Cold War was, if you like, won not just by the United States and the West, but by the Russian people themselves, who overthrew the communist government. And that was very much part of Yeltsin's view and of even of Putin's view. They were stridently and secretly anti-communist, and they worked to overthrow the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Mind you, we saw the Cold War, as we in the West saw it, as a war which didn't have many casualties. But of course, that was a period when the Soviet Union killed about 60 million of its own people. Mao probably killed 60 to 80 million Chinese. So it wasn't a war without casualties. But as we moved into the 21st century, or in the late 20th century, the Chinese, Communist Party of China leadership understood that they would have to be very careful about how they waged war if they were going to survive and prosper and dominate in the 21st century. And they knew that if they got engaged in a kinetic war, in other words, military to military, the outcomes would be uncertain. And they were very conscious of the fact that Japan lost World War II on December the 7th, 1941, when they invaded Pearl Harbor, because they merely set about a conflict which they couldn't control. So the People's Republic of China is engaged in this situation where it is already in a war, and as it said, it is already in a war. In 2018, Xi Jinping and all of his key officials said they were at war with the United States, and they hoped that the United States would not respond militarily. Well, of course, that's hope is not a strategy, but the basic approach was they were going to win, as the great Chinese philosopher Sun Tzu said, they win without fighting, by undermining the economies and political stability of their adversaries. And so you had a war which escalated into every phase of life, and you see it today, it's being fought in TikTok and other mediums around the world, and co-option of social media to, as you say, generate these mass psychoses. Mass and fear is, of course, the easiest emotion to motivate people. So the whole concept of war has become very, very interesting, and yet we in the West think that war is only when two or more military organizations fight each other. And now that really is a concept from the Middle Ages, because it hasn't been that way for a long time, and it is really one where all of society fights against all of another society, and you better have the mechanisms to do it. And of course, we do not. In fact, we allow the national security apparatuses of Western states to be largely dominated by the military. And while the military has a vital role to play, it doesn't describe or understand all of its own society, nor all of the societies of adversary states. In 2020, the Russian government designated the Russian general staff, in other words, the senior military officials, as being in charge of this all-of-nation response to threats and opportunities. But it said so on the basis that they understood that 80% of conflict in the future would be non-military. Now, the Chinese view is that 99% of conflict in the future will be non-military, and they will do almost anything to avoid, the Chinese will do almost anything to avoid a direct kinetic military confrontation, which would engage them with a major power like the United States. So they will bluster, they will use wolf warrior diplomacy, they will threaten, they will coerce, they will bribe, they will use the Belt and Road Initiative, which is not an economic program. It is a program to gain political control, whether it's in the South Pacific or in Africa or elsewhere, but they won't go into armed conflict if they can avoid it. And on those occasions, when they get caught in small-scale military confrontations, as they did with India in the Kashmir region over the past couple of years, that was really disturbing for Beijing. So we have to understand how wars are now being fought and will be fought in the future. There will be a strong military element, but not in the fighting itself, but more in the posturing, because the one thing that the military forces can do is to project power internationally, and they can give prestige to the holder of that power. This is why in 1927, the world cruise of HMS Hood signaled to the world that Britain was back as a global power. And that's why Boris Johnson sent the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier battle group into the Indo-Pacific last year to demonstrate that Britain was back. It was now once again a global trading country, and would project and protect its interests into the entire world stage.
Look, you're living the dream in Washington, D.C., a bit like Disneyland, but a cross between Disneyland and maybe Clockwork Orange, which is a pretty wild place. But just as we wrap this up, and you often hear people saying that, you know, the government is their enemy, which is, when you think about it, you think, well, which is more dangerous at the moment, looking at the US, because you're there? Is it their own government that they need to be more afraid of than, say, China or Russia?
Absolutely. And I think you could say this across Western society. I have seen the enemy, and it is us. We are the greatest enemies to our own growth, our own peace, our own evolution economically and intellectually, and the foreign powers, the Russias, the Chinas, or whatever, are totally secondary in this regard. And I see that in the West in particular, because we are seeing a collapse of modern civilization, because we have moved away from what made Western civilization, which was knowledge and science, as well as values, but we haven't replaced it with anything other than superstitions and belief. We've gone back to the era, the worship of Ra, the sun god, and not into anything which is rationally scientific as we once knew it. And yet, of course, the great protectors of this modern woke society call themselves scientists. And they keep saying, follow the science. They don't want you to follow the science because real science is against this rabid belief system which is being out there to encourage orthodoxy and political correctness.
Mm. It's a very interesting, I mean, you often hear people say, the science is settled. It's not settled, and if it is settled, it isn't science. Look, Greg, we could talk for ages. In fact, I could, and I've always told to shut up sometimes. I talk too much, but you love a good chat too, I can see. Do this more often. Gregory R. Copley, the author of The New Total War of the 21st Century and the Trigger of the Fear Pandemic, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For sale, one deep fat fryer, one industrial fridge freezer, one set of knives, cleaver missing, several hundred plastic forks, one dishwasher, mid-30s, has own teeth, all is new, one careless owner.
Poor hygiene is bad for your business. Fortunately, the Food Standards Agency has a range of tools that can help you manage food hygiene and keep your customers. Visit food.gov.uk/goodbusiness.
Finish your high school diploma for you and your family. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
As Joe Biden negotiates his way out of the room, we don't negotiate with the truth. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We're living in a green, green world. I'm sure there's a song there somewhere, but can't think of it. And sleepwalking our way to disaster. Now, today in the press is this story. Billionaire tech Mike Cannon-Brookes has seemingly cleaned up Australia's biggest polluter, with AGL Energy abandoning plans that would have kept it burning coal for another 20 years. Bring on those batteries. 2.5 minutes, that's it. AGL on Monday morning announced that its top brass would be re-signing and that would no longer attempt to split out its coal assets following a sustained period of pressure from Mr. Cannon-Brookes and other investors. Environmental groups such as Greenpeace Australia cheered this news and said the failure of AGL's demerger represented the failure of its old leadership team. AGL's humiliating demerger backflip has to go down as one of the most bungled and misguided attempts at a corporate restructure in Australian history. That was from Greenpeace senior campaigner Glenn Walker. Now, Mr. Cannon-Brookes has been the figurehead of the push to direct AGL away from producing coal-fired power, a practice the energy firm was keen to keep doing by splitting its heavy polluting assets out into a new company. As we don't get good analysis in mainstream media, we've asked an expert, one who knows just about all, on energy to explain the significance of this story. Dr. Alan Moran is Principal of Regulation Economics, is a noted economist who has analysed and written extensively from a free market perspective. Regulation Economics and associated organisations offer analysis and advice on a range of public policy issues where business and government interact. Dr. Alan Moran was the director of the deregulation unit at the Institute of Public Affairs from 1996 until 2014. He was previously a senior official in Australia's Productivity Commission and director of the Commonwealth's Office of Regulation Review. First of all, Alan, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
There's a lot there. I was just on my first chapter, but you've done a lot. You know a lot, and that's why we have you on at the moment. Can you explain though the significance of this news?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally driving the news is the difficulties which the coal-fired power stations now confront, because instead of having to, instead of wanting to run 24/7, thereby covering all their overheads and all that sort of stuff, and producing power quite cheaply, they now have to adapt to the renewables, which of course can cut in and cut out, and that in the first instance it reduces the length of time that the coal-fired power stations can be covering their overheads, etc. But secondly, it imposes various costs on them. So we've seen in the situation which is coming to light today with AGL, AGL's share price has gone from about $28 to about $8. It's been below that as well. And they've been suddenly losing money, as not suddenly, but over a period of about 3 or 4 years, losing money as a result of the issues connected with their power station's operations. Along comes Mike Cannon-Brookes, and he's got a different agenda. He may have lots of agendas, but his ostensible agenda is that he wants to move Australian electricity from fossil fuels to renewables, which he means wind and solar, and that he wants to close those power stations, the coal ones in particular, but also the gas ones that AGL owns. He wants to close them much faster than AGL is saying. Now, AGL, to actually counter its difficulties before Cannon-Brookes really got involved, sought to actually split itself into two companies. Whether or not that was wise, it's difficult to say, but it certainly has failed, and they are now going back to a single entity, and of course half of the board has resigned, and rightly so, since they basically chose a poor pattern to develop their company on. Not really sure how Cannon-Brookes would have operated it. You know, in a sense, right now, of course, the coal-fired power stations are really making a lot of money, an astonishing amount of money. I mean, you said the electricity price is 5 or 6 times what it was a year ago. These coal-fired power stations, particularly they've either got long-term contracts in the case of Liddell and Bayswater, or they actually own their own coal in the case of Loy Yang. So this coal costs them nothing, nothing more than it used to cost them, in a context where they can now effectively sell it for 5 or 6 or 7 times as much as they used to sell it. So they have proved immensely profitable. The objectives of Cannon-Brookes in actually seeking, if that's what he intends to do, to close those coal-powered fire stations down quickly, would actually be destructive of the value of the company. And although the solution which the previous outgoing directors had was clearly faulty, it's not clear that the successors will choose something markedly different. I mean, they certainly won't split the company up into two separate entities, but essentially the company is two separate entities. It's on the one hand, it's a retailer, and it's got about a quarter of the Australian market. And on the other hand, it's a generator, and that actually produces the energy, the juice itself, that goes into the electricity supplied by their retailers. So it is two companies now, and it's difficult to see how it will ever operate other than as two companies until the coal assets are closed down. But the Cannon-Brookes really only owns 11%, and perhaps doesn't even own that much. And he's likely to only have one of the 8 board positions. So he won't be controlling the company itself. And, you know, its future generation and operations are likely to be somewhat different from they were just 5 or 6 months ago, because of this massive increase in the coal price and the electricity price.
What do you think will result from, say, this decision as far as AGL is concerned?
Well, I think AGL may well get broken up. But I mean, it's a company just with a series of assets. It's, you know, it's it's not an integrated company in the sense that these assets have to be operated together. They weren't operated together in the past. They wouldn't be in the future. It may well be that AGL, the successor board, will say, well, we've got these power stations. If anyone wants to buy them, they're for sale. And we'll sell them on that basis. I mean, the real problem with buying power stations, coal power stations in particular, is that you have to run them in the teeth of competition from wind and solar, especially, which has been subsidized. So until the massive increases in prices occurred in the last 3 months, essentially, if you were a wind or a solar power operator, you got half your money from the market itself, from selling electricity, and the other half came from subsidies from the consumer, which the consumer actually didn't know he's paying the subsidies, but it's because he's rolled in various other prices. So you're as a coal-fired generator, you're facing competition which gets twice the price that you get, and which can come in and out and play havoc with your costs. So you know the long term, it's a very difficult to see how those generators, coal generators, exist, at least on the present scale and the present numbers that they comprise, and they're always going to be undercut by this subsidized competition. So anybody buying the power stations right now would be making a lot of money, especially if they buy them cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Right now would be making an awful lot of money. But you know, in terms of the hostility to coal, which the Labour government will be even more hostile than the Liberals were, of course, in terms of subsidising their competitors, it's always going to be difficult to run these generators in the market which has been evolved and which has been developed, and the regulations which have been developed by the successive governments.
What do you think will happen? Because I look at the Greens, they're like, those horror shows with Chucky, that thing that ran around with a knife in his hand stabbing people. That's what Adam Band is and all the others are like towards our economy. What do you think will actually happen with the Labor Party and in conjunction with the Greens and proudly clapped on by the Teals? Do you think they will do everything on steroids and create an abomination of a future for us when it comes to energy?
Well, that's what the Greens would do. Maybe the Labour Party would as well.
Mm.
But they, you know, in being in government brings about a new reality. You know, it's all very well when you're in opposition, we're gonna do this, we're gonna do that. When you're in government and say people, then the public servants come and say, well, you know, we agree with the policy, which is terrific. But if you do that, if you actually do close down these coal-fired stations earlier than was intended, and we do go to this system of maybe 60 or 80% renewables by 2030, which isn't that far away, these will be the costs. And the Labour government has actually said one of the costs, but it hasn't really said what its implications are. For example, they've said we're going to put $20 billion into a new transmission, which will be wind and solar friendly transmission, and we expect this to leverage an additional $60 billion from the private sector. So in other words, there's $80 billion for the new Butte transmission system, which is actually going to replace a transmission system we have at the present time, which is only $20 billion.
Mm.
So one way or another, the cost of transmission, which is one of the three components of electricity, will increase fourfold. That adds up to about a 50% increase on people's bills. Or if the government does it by taxes, that people are paying more money in terms of income tax and sales tax. So, you know, what will happen? There's a reality will come to bear on the new incoming government when they get proper briefings, and they may well put off some of these decisions. I mean, they've already indicated they might do that they're going to have, you know, a damn good chin wag with a whole lot of people before they make some indelible decisions. So we'll see some of that slow down in there. But, you know, you said the Labour Party's like the Libs on steroids, and the Libs themselves have had a policy, a very aggressive policy to undercut coal. They'd slowed it down somewhat when they could. I mean, certainly in terms of Tony Abbott, he tried to stop it totally. But in the transition then to Turnbull, and then later on to Morrison, there was some climbing back on board of the renewable bandwagon to a limited degree. But now you can see certainly the ALP will be pushing it forward, and there will be additional costs as a result of that, which of course, you know, we'll find in our bills as households. And what will need to happen, the present price of electricity in terms of the juice going in, that's a generation part, which is only about a third of the total cost of electricity, because the rest is poles and wires.
I have to cut you short because we're about to go to the news. We will continue this. This is TNT Radio.